Shinto. Gordon, the self-made cat. Peter S. Beagle.
Peter S. Beagle was born in Manhattan in 1939 and raised in the Bronx. He originally proclaimed he would be a writer when 10 years old and is now acknowledged as an American fantasy icon. In addition to being an acclaimed novelist and writer of short stories and nonfiction, Peter also has written numerous plays, teleplays, and screenplays, and is a gifted poet, librettist, lyricist, and singer-songwriter. For more information about The Last Unicorn, A Fine and Private Place, Summerlong, I'm Afraid You've Got Dragons, I See by My Outfit, Two Hearts, and the rest of his work, visit www.peterbeagle.com. Gordon, the self-made cat, started life in the late 1960s when Beagle was asked by a relatively small and now defunct animation company to submit ideas for possible feature-length development. Nothing came of it, and the story languished until late 2001, when a friend discovered the manuscript while hunting through a rusty filing cabinet in the author's garage. After several revisions, Gordon was published in Beagle's email newsletter, The Raven, as a freebie, and then reprinted in his collection, The Line Between. He is now expanding the story into a standalone children's book. Beagle had a Persian cat named Princess Grace, the original of Miss Sophia Brown in his novel Tamsin, who hung out entirely with the dogs. She never once looked at another cat, and was a fully accepted member of the pack. Gordon is an outgrowth of his speculation on what a mouse equivalent of Princess Grace, the hussy, as his kids called her, might be like.
Once upon a time, to a family of house mice, there was born a son named Gordon. He looked very much like his father and mother, and all his brothers and sisters, who were gray and had bright, twitchy black eyes. But what went on inside Gordon was very different from what went on inside the rest of his family. He was forever asking why everything had to be the way it was, and never satisfied with the answer. Why did mice eat cheese? Why did they live in the dark and only go out when it was dark? Where did mice come from, anyway? What were people? Why did people smell so funny? Suppose mice were big and people were tiny. Suppose mice could fly. Most mice don't ask many questions, but Gordon never stopped. One evening, when Gordon was only a few weeks old, his next-to-eldest sister was sent out to see if anything interesting had been left open in the pantry. She never returned. Gordon's father shrugged sadly and spread his front paws and said, "The cat." "What's a cat?" Gordon asked. His mother and father looked at one another and sighed.
"They have to know sometime," his father said. "Better he learns it at home than on the streets."
His mother sniffled a little and said,
"But he's so young."
And his father answered,
"Cats don't care."
So they told Gordon about cats right then, expecting him to start crying and saying that there wasn't any such things. It's a hard idea to get used to. But Gordon only asked,
"Why do cats eat mice?"
"I guess we taste very good," his father said.
Gordon said,
"But cats don't have to eat mice. They get plenty of other food that probably tastes as good. Why should anybody eat anybody if he doesn't have to?"
"Gordon," said his father, "listen to me. There are two kinds of creatures in the world. There are animals that hunt and animals that are hunted. We mice just happen to be the kind of animal that gets hunted. And it doesn't really matter if the cat is hungry or not. It's the way life is. It's really a great honor to be the hunted, if you just look at it the right way."
"Phooey on that," said Gordon. "Where do I go to learn to be a cat?"
They thought he was joking, but as soon as Gordon was old enough to go places by himself, He packed a clean shirt and some peanut butter and started off for cat school.
"I love you very much," he said to his parents before he left, "but this business of being hunted for the rest of my life just because I happen to be born a mouse is not for me."
And off he went, all by himself.
All cats go to school, you know, whether you ever see them going or not. Dogs don't, but cats always have and always will. There are a great many cat schools, so Gordon found one easily enough, and he walked bravely up the front steps and knocked at the door. He said that he wanted to speak to the principal. He almost expected to be eaten right there, but the cats, students and teachers alike, were so astonished that they let him pass through, and one of the teachers took him to the principal's office. Gordon could feel the cats looking at him and hear the sounds their noses made as they smelled how good he was. But he held on tight to the suitcase with his shirt and the peanut butter, and he never looked back. The principal was a fat old tiger cat who chewed on his tail all the time he was talking to Gordon.
"You must be out of your mind," he said when Gordon told him he wanted to be a cat. "I'd smack you up this minute, but it's bad luck to eat crazies. Get out of here. The day mice go to cat school."
"Why not?" said Gordon. "Is it in writing? Where does it say that I can't go to school here if I want?"
"Well, of course, there's nothing in the rules of cat schools that says mice can't enroll. Nobody ever thought of putting it in." The principal folded his paws and said,
"Gordon, look at it this way."
"You look at it my way," said Gordon. "I want to be a cat, and I bet I'd make a better one than the dopey-looking animals I've seen in this school. Most of them look as if they wouldn't even make good mice. So let's make a deal. You let me come to school here and study for one term, and if at the end of that time I'm not doing better than any cat in the school, if even one cat has better grades than I have, then you can eat me, and that'll be the end of it. Is that fair?"
No cat can resist a challenge like that. But before agreeing, the principal insisted on one small change. At the end of the term, if Gordon didn't have the very best marks in the school, then the privilege of eating him would go to the cat that did.
"Ought to encourage some of those louts to work harder," the principal said to himself as Gordon left his office. "He's crazy, but he's right. Most of them wouldn't even make good mice. I almost hope he does it."
So Gordon went to cat school. Every day he sat at his special little desk, surrounded by 100 kittens and half-grown cats, who would have liked nothing better than to leap on him and play games with him for a while before they gobbled him. He learned how to wash himself, and what to do to keep his claws sharp, and how to watch everything in the room while pretending to be asleep. There was a class on dealing with dogs, and another on getting down from trees, which is much harder than climbing up, and also a particularly scholarly seminar on the various meanings of bad kitty. Gordon's personal favorite was the visions class, which had to do with the enchanting things all cats can see that no one else ever does, the great gliding ancestors and faraway castles, and mysterious forests full of monsters to chase. The professor of visions told his colleagues that he had never had such a brilliant student.
"It would be a crime to eat such a mouse," he proclaimed everywhere. "An absolute, shameful, yummy crime."
The class in mouse hunting was a bit awkward at first, because usually the teacher asks one of the students to be the mouse, and in Gordon's case the principal felt that would be too risky. But Gordon insisted on being chased like everyone else, and not only was he never caught, well, almost never. There was one blue Persian who could turn on a dime. But when he took his own turn at chasing, he proved to be a natural expert. In fact, his instant mastery of the flying pounce caused his teacher and the entire class to sit up and applaud. Gordon took 3 bows and an encore. There was also a class where the cats learned the necessities of getting along with people, how to lie in laps, how to keep from scratching furniture even when you feel you have to, what to do when children pick you up, and how to ask for food or affection in such a sweet manner that people call other people to look at you. These classes always made Gordon a little sad. He didn't suppose that he would ever be a real people cat, for who would want to hold a mouse on his lap or scratch it behind the ears while it purred? Still, he paid strict attention in people class, as he did in all the others, for all the cats knew that whoever did best in school that term would be the one who ate him, and they worked harder than they ever had in their lives. The principal said that they were becoming the best students in the school's history, and he talked openly about making this a regular thing, one mouse to a term. When all the marks were in, and all the grades added up, two students led the rankings, Gordon and the Blue Persian. Their scores weren't even a whisker's thickness apart. In the really important classes, like running and pouncing, climbing, stalking, and waiting for the prey to forget you're still there. And in matters of feline manners, such as washing, tail etiquette, the elegant yawn, sleeping in undignified positions, and making sure you get enough food without looking greedy, 101 and 102. In all of these, Gordon and the Blue Persian were first, and the rest nowhere. Besides that, both could meow in 5 different dialects, Persian, Abyssian, Siamese, Burmese, which almost no cat who isn't Burmese ever learns, and basic tiger. But there can only be one top cat to a term, no ties allowed. In order to decide the matter once and for all between them, the principal announced that Gordon and the Blue Persian would have to face one another in a competitive mouse roundup. The Persian and Gordon got along quite well, all things considered, so they shook paws, carefully, and the Persian purred.
"No hard feelings." "None at all," Gordon answered. "If anyone here got to eat me, I'd much rather it was you."
"Very sporting of you," the Persian said. "I hope so, too."
"But it won't happen," Gordon said.
The Blue Persian never had a chance. Once he and Gordon were set on their marks in a populous mouse neighborhood, Gordon ambushed and outsmarted and cornered all but a handful of the very quickest mice, and did it in a style so smooth, so effortlessly elegant, so cat-like, that the Persian finally threw up his paws and surrendered. In front of the entire faculty and student body of the cat school, he announced,
"I yield to Gordon. He's a better cat than I am, and I'm not ashamed to admit it. If all mice were like him, we cats would be vegetarians."
Persians are very dramatic. The cheering was so wild and thunderous that no one objected in the least when Gordon freed all the mice he had captured. Cats can appreciate a grand gesture, and everyone had already had lunch. Gordon had won his bet, and like the Blue Persian, the principal was cat enough to accept it graciously. He scheduled a celebration, which the whole school attended, and at the end of the party he announced that Gordon was now to be considered as much a cat as any student in the school, if not more so. He gave Gordon a little card to show that he was a cat in good standing, and all the students cheered, and Gordon made another speech that began,
"Fellow cats!"
As he spoke, he wished very much that his parents could be there to see what he had accomplished, and just how different things could be if you just asked questions and weren't afraid of new ideas. Being acknowledged the best cat in the school didn't make Gordon let up in his studies. Instead, he worked even harder and did so well that he graduated with the special degree of Felis Maximus, which is Latin for some cat. He stayed on at the school to teach a seminar in evasive maneuvers, which proved very popular, and a course in the standing jump, for a bird that comes flying over when you weren't looking. The story of his new life spread everywhere among all mice, and grew very quickly into a myth more terrifying than any cat could have been. They whispered of Gordon the Terrible, Gordon the Self-Made Cat, and simply, the Unspeakable, and told midnight tales of a gigantic mouse who lashed his tail and sprang at them with his razor claws out and his savage yellow eyes blazing, a mouse without pity who hunted them out in their deepest hiding places, walking without a sound. They believed unquestioningly that he ate mice like ginger snaps and laughingly handed over to his cat friends those he was too full to devour. There was even a dreadful legend that Gordon had eaten his own family, and that he frequently took kittens from the school on field trips in order to teach them personally the secret mouse ways that no mere cat could ever have known. These stories made Gordon deeply unhappy when he heard them, because he believed with absolute conviction that what he had achieved was for the good of all mice everywhere. Whether he trapped a lone mouse or cornered a dozen trembling in an attic or behind a refrigerator, he would say the same thing to them.
Look at me. Look at me. I am a mouse like you, nothing more, nothing less. And yet I walk with cats every day, and I am not eaten. I am respected. I am admired. I am even powerful among cats. And every one of you could be like me. Do not believe that we mice are born only to be hunted, humiliated, tormented, and finally gobbled up. It is not true. Instead of huddling in the shadows, in constant lifelong terror, pitiful little balls of fur, we too can be sleek, fierce hunters, fearing nothing and no one. Run now and spread the word. You must spread the word.
Saying that, he would step back and let the mice scatter, hoping each time that they would finally understand what he was trying to show them. But it simply never happened. The mice always scurried away, convinced that they had escaped only by great good fortune, and myths and legends of the terrible self-made cat were all that spread among them, growing ever more horrifying, ever more chilling. It didn't matter that not one mouse had ever actually seen Gordon doing any of the frightful things he was supposed to have done. That's the way it is with legends. Now it happened that Gordon was walking down the street one day, on his way to a faculty meeting, padding along like a leopard, twitching his tail like a lion, and making the eager little noises in his throat that a tiger makes when he smells food. Quite suddenly, an enormous shadow fell across his path, so big that he looked up to see if he were going through a tunnel. What he saw was a dog. What he actually saw was a leg. For this dog was huge, too big for even a full-grown cat to have understood his real size without looking twice. The dog rumbled,
"Oh, goody. I love mice. Lots of phosphorus in mice. Yummy."
Gordon crouched, tail lashing, and lifted the fur along his spine.
"Watch it, dog," he said warningly. "Don't mess with me, I'm telling you."
"Oh, how cute," the dog said. "He's playing he's a cat. I'm a cat, too. Meow."
"I am a cat."
Gordon arched his back until it ached, hissing and spitting and growling in his throat, all more or less at the same time.
"I am. You want to see my card? Look, right here."
"A crazy," the dog said wonderingly. "They say it's bad luck to eat a crazy. Good thing I'm not superstitious."
Having given the proper first warning, exactly as he'd been taught, Gordon moved quickly to the second, the lightning-swift slash of the right paw across the nose. Gordon had to leap straight up to reach the dog's big wet nose, but even with that handicap, he executed the second warning in superb style. Instead of yelping and retreating in a properly humbled state, however, the dog only sneezed. This, Gordon thought, is the difference between theory and practice. But there was a reason that Gordon's seminar in evasive maneuvers was always so well attended. With astonishing daring, he went directly from the second warning right into the fourth avoidance, which involves a double feint, head looking this way, tail jerking that way, followed by a quick, threatening charge directly at the attacker, and then a leap to the side, which, done correctly, leaves one perfectly poised either for escape or the flying pounce, depending on the situation. But the big dog had no idea that a classic evasive maneuver had just been performed upon him, leaving him looking like an idiot. He was used to looking like an idiot. He gave a delighted bounce, woofed,
"Tag, you're it,"
and went straight for Gordon, who responded by going up a tree with the polished grace that always left his students too breathless to cheer. He found a comfortable branch and rested there, thinking ruefully that a real cat wouldn't have been so proud of being a cat as to waste time arguing about it. The dog sat down too, grinning.
"Be a bird now," he called to Gordon. Let's see you be a bird and fly away.
Normally, Gordon could easily have stayed up in the tree longer than the dog felt like waiting below. But he was tired and rather thirsty, not to mention annoyed at the thought of being late for the faculty meeting. Something had to be done. But what? He was bravely considering an original plan of leaping straight down at the dog when three young mice happened along. They had been out shopping for their mother. They were really very young, and as they had never seen Gordon the Terrible, though they had heard about him since they were blind babies, they didn't know who it was in the tree. All they saw was a fellow mouse in danger, and, being at the age where they didn't know any better than to do things like that, they carefully put down their packages and began luring the dog away from the tree. First one mouse would rush in at him and make the dog chase him a little way, and then another would come scampering from somewhere else, so that the dog would leave off chasing the first mouse and go after him. The dog, who was actually quite good-natured and not very hungry, had a fine time running after them all. He followed them farther and farther away from the tree, and had probably forgotten all about Gordon by the time the unspeakable was able to spring down from the tree and vanish into the bushes. Gordon would have waited to thank the three mice, but they had disappeared, along with the dog. Anxious not to miss his meeting, he dashed back to the school, slowing down before he got there to catch his breath and smooth his whiskers.
It could happen to anyone, he told himself. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
Yet, there was something fundamentally troubling to Gordon about having run away. Feeling uncertain for the first time since he had marched up the front steps, he washed himself all over and stalked on into the school, outwardly calm and proud, the best cat anyone there would ever see, Gordon the Terrible, the Unspeakable, yes, the self-made cat. But another cat, the assistant professor of tail chasing, in fact, had seen the whole incident and had already interrupted the faculty meeting with the shocking tale. The principal tried to brush the news aside.
When it's time to climb a tree, you climb a tree, he said. Any cat knows that.
He had become quite fond of Gordon, in his way. It wasn't enough. The assistant professor of tail chasing, a chocolate point Siamese who dreamed of one day heading the school himself, led the opposition. As the assistant professor saw it, Gordon was plainly a fraud, a pretender, a cat in card only, so friendly with his fellow mice that they had rushed to help him when he was in danger. In light of that, who could say what Gordon's real plans might be? Why had he come to the school in the first place? What if more like him followed? What if the mice were plotting to attack the cat school, all cat schools? This thought rattled everyone at the table. With a mouse like Gordon in their midst, a mouse who knew far more about being a cat than the cats themselves, was any feline safe? Just that quickly, fear replaced reason. Within minutes, everyone but the principal forgot how much they had liked and admired Gordon. Admitting him to the school had been a catastrophic mistake, one that must be set right without a moment's delay. The principal groaned and covered his eyes and sent for Gordon. He was almost crying as he took Gordon's cat card away. Gordon protested like mad, of course. He spoke of will and choice and freedom and the transforming power of questioning assumptions. But the principal said sadly,
"We just can't trust you, Gordon. Go away now, before I eat you myself. I always wondered what you'd taste like."
Then he put his head down on his desk and really did begin to cry. So Gordon packed his clean shirt and his leftover peanut butter and left the cat school. All the cats formed a double line to let him pass, their faces turned away, and nobody said a word. The assistant professor of tail chasing was poised to pounce at the very last, but the principal stepped on his tail. Nobody ever heard of Gordon again. There were stories that he'd gone right on being a cat, even without his card. And there were other tales that said he had been driven out of the country by the mice themselves. But only the principal knew for sure, because only the principal had heard the words that Gordon was muttering to himself as he walked away from the cat school with his head held high. Woof, Gordon was murmuring thoughtfully.
Woof. Bow wow. Shouldn't be too hard.
The Jaguar Hunter. Lucius Shepherd.
Lucius Shepherd was born in Lynchburg, Virginia, grew up in Daytona Beach, Florida, and lives in Portland, Oregon. His short fiction has won the Nebula Award, the Hugo Award, the International Horror Guild Award, the National Magazine Award, the Locus Award, the Theodore Sturgeon Award, and the World Fantasy Award. His most recent books are a short fiction collection, Viator Plus, and a short novel, The Taborin Scale. Forthcoming are another short fiction collection, 5 autobiographies, and 2 novels, tentatively titled The Pierce Fields and The End of Life as We Know It, and a short novel, The House of Everything and Nothing. The Jaguar Hunter is based on a story told to Shepherd in a bar in Telus, Honduras, by an old and very drunk man.
It was his wife's debt to Onofrio Estevez, the appliance dealer, that brought Esteban Cax to town for the first time in almost a year. By nature, he was a man who enjoyed the sweetness of the countryside above all else. The placid measures of a farmer's day invigorated him, and he took great pleasure in nights spent joking and telling stories around a fire, or lying beside his wife, Encarnacion. Puerto Morada, with its fruit company imperatives and sullen dogs and cantinas that blared American music, was a place he avoided like the plague. Indeed, from his home atop the mountain, whose slopes form the northernmost enclosure of Bahia Honda, the rusted tin roofs ringing the bay resembled a dried crust of blood, such as might appear upon the lips of a dying man. On this particular morning, however, he had no choice but to visit the town. Encarnacion had, without his knowledge, purchased a battery-operated television set on credit from Onofrio, and he was threatening to seize Esteban's 3 milk cows in lieu of the 800 lempiras that was owed. He refused to accept the return of the television, but had sent word that he was willing to discuss an alternate method of payment. Should Esteban lose the cows, his income would drop below a subsistence level, and he would be forced to take up his old occupation, an occupation far more onerous than farming. As he walked down the mountain, past huts of thatch and brushwood poles identical to his own, following a trail that wound through sun-brown thickets lorded over by banana trees, he was not thinking of Onofrio, but of Encarnacion. It was in her nature to be frivolous, and he had known this when he had married her. Yet the television was emblematic of the differences that had developed between them since their children had reached maturity. She had begun to put on sophisticated airs, to laugh at Esteban's country ways, and she had become the doyen of a group of older women, mostly widows, all of whom aspired to sophistication. Each night they would huddle around the television and strive to outdo one another in making sagacious comments about the American detective shows they watched. And each night, Esteban would sit outside the hut and gloomily ponder the state of his marriage. He believed Encarnacion's association with the widows was her manner of telling him that she looked forward to adopting the black skirt and shawl, that, having served his purpose as a father, he was now an impediment to her. Though she was only 41, younger by 3 years than Esteban, she was withdrawing from the life of the senses. They rarely made love anymore, and he was certain that this partially embodied her resentment to the fact that the years had been kind to him. He had the look of one of the old Patuca, tall, with chiseled features and wide-set eyes. His coppery skin was relatively unlined, and his hair jet black. Encarnacion's hair was streaked with gray, and the clean beauty of her limbs had dissolved beneath layers of fat. He had not expected her to remain beautiful, and he had tried to assure her that he loved the woman she was, and not merely the girl she had been. But that woman was dying, infected by the same disease that had infected Puerto Morada, and perhaps his love for her was dying too. The dusty street on which the appliance store was situated ran in back of the movie theater and the Hotel Circle del Mar, and from the inland side of the street, Esteban could see the bell towers of Santa Maria del Onda rising above the hotel roof like the horns of a great stone snail. As a young man, obeying his mother's wish that he become a priest, he had spent 3 years cloistered beneath those towers, preparing for the seminary under the tutelage of old Father Gonsalvo. It was the part of his life he most regretted, because the academic disciplines he had mastered seemed to have stranded him between the world of the Indian and that of contemporary society. In his heart, he held to his father's teachings, the principles of magic, the history of the tribe, the lore of nature, and yet he could never escape the feeling that such wisdom was either superstitious or simply unimportant. The shadows of the towers lay upon his soul as surely as they did upon the cobbled square in front of the church, and the sight of them caused him to pick up his pace and lower his eyes. Farther along the street was the Cantina Atomica, a gathering place for the well-to-do youth of the town, and across from it was the appliance store, a one-story building of yellow stucco, with corrugated metal doors that were lowered at night. Its facade was decorated by a mural that supposedly represented the merchandise within, sparkling refrigerators and televisions and washing machines, all given the impression of enormity by the tiny men and women painted below them, their hands upflung in awe. The actual merchandise was much less imposing, consisting mainly of radios and used kitchen equipment. Few people in Puerto Morata could afford more, and those who could generally bought elsewhere. The majority of Onofrio's clientele were poor, hard-pressed to meet his schedule of payments, and to a large degree, his wealth derived from selling repossessed appliances over and over. Raimundo Estevez, a pale young man with puffy cheeks and heavily lidded eyes and a petulant mouth, was leaning against the counter when Esteban entered. Raimundo smirked and let out a piercing whistle, and a few seconds later his father emerged from the back room, a huge slug of a man, even paler than Raimundo. Filaments of gray hair were slicked down across his mottled scalp, and his belly stretched the front of a starched guayabera. He beamed and extended a hand.
"How good to see you," he said. "Raimundo, bring us coffee and 2 chairs.
Much as he disliked Onofrio, Esteban was in no position to be uncivil. He accepted the handshake. Raimundo spilled coffee in the saucers and clattered the chairs and glowered, angry at being forced to serve an Indian. "Why will you not let me return the television?" asked Esteban, after taking a seat. And then, unable to bite back the words, he added, "Is it no longer your policy to swindle my people?" Onofrio sighed, as if it were exhausting to explain things to a fool such as Esteban.
"I do not swindle your people. I go beyond the letter of the contracts in allowing them to make returns, rather than pursuing matters through the courts. In your case, however, I have devised a way whereby you can keep the television without any further payments and yet settle the account. Is this a swindle?"
It was pointless to argue with a man whose logic was as facile and self-serving as Onofrio's. "Tell me what you want," said Esteban. Onofrio wetted his lips, which were the color of raw sausage.
"I want you to kill the jaguar of Barrio Carolina."
"I no longer hunt," said Esteban.
"The Indian is afraid," said Raimundo, moving up behind Onofrio's shoulder. "I told you."
Onofrio waved him away and said to Esteban,
"That is unreasonable. If I take the cows, you will once again be hunting jaguars. But if you do this, you will have to hunt only one jaguar.
One that has killed 8 hunters.
Esteban set down his coffee cup and stood. "It is no ordinary jaguar." Raimundo laughed disparagingly, and Esteban skewered him with a stare.
"Ah,"
said Onofrio, smiling a flatterer's smile.
"But none of the 8 use your method."
"Your pardon, Don Onofrio," said Esteban with mock formality. "I have other business to attend."
"I will pay you 500 lempiras in addition to erasing the debt," said Onofrio.
"Why?" asked Esteban.
"Forgive me, but I cannot believe it is due to a concern for the public welfare.
Onofrio's fat throat pulsed. His face darkened. Never mind, said Esteban. It is not enough.
Very well. 1,000.
Onofrio's casual manner could not conceal the anxiety in his voice. Intrigued, curious to learn the extent of Onofrio's anxiety, Esteban plucked a figure from the air. 10,000, he said, and in advance.
Ridiculous. I could hire 10 hunters for this much. 20.
Esteban shrugged, but none with my method. For a moment, Onofrio sat with hands enlaced, twisting them, as if struggling with some pious conception.
All right, he said, the words squeezed out of him. 10,000.
The reason for Onofrio's interest in Barrio Carolina suddenly dawned on Esteban, and he understood that the profits involved would make his fees seem pitifully small. But he was possessed by the thought of what 10,000 lempiras could mean. A herd of cows, a small truck to haul produce, or... And as he thought it, he realized this was the happiest possibility. The little stucco house in Barrio Clarín that Encarnacion had set her heart on. Perhaps owning it would soften her toward him. He noticed Raimundo staring at him, his expression a knowing smirk, and even Onofrio, though still outraged by the fee, was beginning to show signs of satisfaction, adjusting the fit of his guayabera, slicking down his already slicked down hair. Esteban felt debased by their capacity to buy him, and to preserve a last shred of dignity, he turned and walked to the door. I will consider it, he tossed back over his shoulder, and I will give you my answer in the morning. Murder Squad of New York, starring a bald American actor, was the featured attraction on Encarnacion's television that night, and the widow sat cross-legged on the floor, filling the hut so completely that the charcoal stove and the sleeping hammock had to be moved outside in order to provide good viewing angles for the latecomers. To Esteban, standing in the doorway, it seemed his home had been invaded by a covey of large black birds with cowled heads, who were receiving evil instruction from the core of a flickering gray jewel. Reluctantly, he pushed between them and made his way to the shelves mounted on the wall behind the set. He reached up to the top shelf and pulled down a long bundle wrapped in oil-stained newspapers. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Encarnacion watching him. Her lips thinned, curved in a smile, and that cicatrix of a smile branded its mark on Esteban's heart. She knew what he was about, and she was delighted, not in the least worried. Perhaps she had known of Onofrio's plan to kill the jaguar. Perhaps she had schemed with Onofrio to entrap him. Infuriated, he barged through the widows, setting them to gabbling, and walked out into his banana grove and sat on a stone amidst it. The night was cloudy, and only a handful of stars showed between the tattered dark shapes of the leaves. The wind sent the leaves slithering together, and he heard one of his cows snorting and smelled the ripe odor of the corral. It was as if the solidity of his life had been reduced to this isolated perspective, and he bitterly felt the isolation. Though he would admit to fault in the marriage, he could think of nothing he had done that could have bred Encarnacion's hateful smile. After a while, he unwrapped the bundle of newspapers and drew out a thin-bladed machete of the sort used to chop banana stalks, but which he used to kill jaguars. Just holding it renewed his confidence and gave him a feeling of strength. It had been 4 years since he had hunted, yet he knew he had not lost the skill. Once he had been proclaimed the greatest hunter in the province of Nueva Esperanza, as had his father before him, and he had not retired from hunting because of age or infirmity, but because the jaguars were beautiful, and their beauty had begun to outweigh the reasons he had for killing them. He had no better reason to kill the jaguar of Barrio Carolina. It menaced no one other than those who hunted it, who sought to invade its territory, and its death would profit only a dishonorable man and a shrewish wife, and would spread the contamination of Puerto Morada. And besides, it was a black jaguar. Black jaguars, his father had told him, are creatures of the moon. They have other forms and magical purposes with which we must not interfere. Never hunt them. His father had not said that the black jaguars lived on the moon, simply that they utilized its power. But as a child, Esteban had dreamed about a moon of ivory forests and silver meadows through which the jaguars flowed as swiftly as black water. And when he had told his father of the dreams, his father had said that such dreams were representations of a truth, and that sooner or later he would discover the truth underlying them. Esteban had never stopped believing in the dreams, not even in face of the rocky, airless place depicted by the science programs on Encarnacion's television. That moon, its mystery explained, was merely a less enlightening kind of dream, a statement of fact that reduced reality to the knowable. But as he thought this, Esteban suddenly realized that killing the jaguar might be the solution to his problems, that by going against his father's teaching, that by killing his dreams, his Indian conception of the world, he might be able to find accord with his wife's. He had been standing halfway between the two conceptions for too long, and it was time for him to choose. And there was no real choice. It was this world he inhabited, not that of the jaguars. If it took the death of a magical creature to permit him to embrace as joys the television and trips to the movies and a stucco house in Barrio Clarín, well, he had faith in this method. He swung the machete, slicing the dark air, and laughed. Encarnacion's frivolousness, his skill at hunting, Onofrio's greed, the jaguar, the television. All these things were neatly woven together like the elements of a spell, one whose products would be a denial of magic and a furthering of the unmagical doctrines that had corrupted Puerto Morada. He laughed again, but a second later he chided himself. It was exactly this sort of thinking he was preparing to root out. Esteban waked Encarnacion early the next morning and forced her to accompany him to the appliance store. His machete swung by his side in a leather sheath, and he carried a burlap sack containing food and the herbs he would need for the hunt. Encarnacion trotted along beside him, silent, her face hidden by a shawl. When they reached the store, Esteban had Onofrio stamp the bill, paid in full. Then he handed the bill and the money to Encarnacion. "If I kill the jaguar, or if it kills me," he said harshly, "this will be yours. Should I fail to return within a week, you may assume that I will never return." She retreated a step, her face registering alarm, as if she had seen him in a new light and understood the consequences of her actions. But she made no move to stop him as he walked out the door. Across the street, Raimundo Estevez was leaning against the wall of the Cantina Atomica, talking to two girls wearing jeans and frilly blouses. The girls were fluttering their hands and dancing to the music that issued from the cantina, and to Esteban, they seemed more alien than the creature he was to hunt. Raimundo spotted him and whispered to the girls. They peeked over their shoulders and laughed. Already angry at Encarnacion, Esteban was washed over by a cold fury. He crossed the street to them, rested his hand on the hilt of the machete, and stared at Raimundo. He had never before noticed how soft he was, how empty of presence. A crop of pimples straggled along his jaw. The flesh beneath his eyes was pocked by tiny indentions like those made by a silversmith's hammer. And unequal to the stare, his eyes darted back and forth between the two girls. Esteban's anger dissolved into revulsion. "I am Esteban Cax," he said. "I have built my own house, tilled my soil, and brought four children into the world. This day I am going to hunt the jaguar of Barrio Carolina, in order to make you and your father even fatter than you are." He ran his gaze up and down Raimundo's body, and letting his voice fill with disgust, he asked, "Who are you?" Raimundo's puffy face cinched in a knot of hatred, but he offered no response. The girls tittered and skipped through the door of the cantina. Esteban could hear them describing the incident, laughter, and he continued to stare at Raimundo. Several other girls poked their heads out the door, giggling and whispering. After a moment, Esteban spun on his heel and walked away. Behind him, there was a chorus of unrestrained laughter, and a girl's voice called mockingly, "Raimundo, who are you?" Other voices joined in, and it soon became a chant. Barrio Carolina was not truly a barrio of Puerto Morata. It lay beyond Punta Manabique, the southernmost enclosure of the bay, and was fronted by a palm hammock and the loveliest stretch of beach in all the province, a curving slice of white sand giving way to jade-green shallows. 40 years before, it had been the headquarters of the fruit company's experimental farm, a project of such vast scope that a small town had been built on the site, rows of white frame houses with shingle roofs and screen porches, the kind you might see in a magazine illustration of rural America. The company had touted the project as being the keystone of the country's future, and had promised to develop high-yield crops that would banish starvation. But in 1947, a cholera epidemic had ravaged the coast, and the town had been abandoned. By the time the cholera scare had died down, the company had become well entrenched in national politics and no longer needed to maintain a benevolent image. The project had been dropped and the property abandoned until, in the same year that Esteban had retired from hunting, developers had bought it, planning to build a major resort. It was then the jaguar had appeared. Though it had not killed any of the workmen, it had terrorized them to the point that they had refused to begin the job. Hunters had been sent, and these the jaguar had killed. The last party of hunters had been equipped with automatic rifles, all manner of technological aids, but the jaguar had picked them off one by one, and this project, too, had been abandoned. Rumor had it that the land had recently been resold. Now Esteban knew to whom, and that the idea of a resort was once more under consideration. The walk from Puerto Morata was hot and tiring, and upon arrival Esteban sat beneath a palm and ate a lunch of cold banana fritters. Combers, as white as toothpaste, broke on the shore, and there was no human litter, just dead fronds and driftwood and coconuts. All but four of the houses had been swallowed by the jungle, and only sections of those four remained visible, embedded like moldering gates in a blackish-green wall of vegetation. Even under the bright sunlight, they were haunted-looking, their screens ripped, boards weathered gray, vines cascading over their facades. A mango tree had sprouted from one of the porches, and wild parrots were eating its fruit. He had not visited the barrio since childhood. The ruins had frightened him then, but now he found them appealing, testifying to the dominion of natural law. It distressed him that he would help transform it all into a place where the parrots would be chained to perches, and the jaguars would be designs on tablecloths, a place of swimming pools and tourists sipping from coconut shells. Nonetheless, after he had finished lunch, he set out to explore the jungle and soon discovered a trail used by the jaguar, a narrow path that wound between the vine-matted shells of the houses for about a half mile and ended at the Rio Dulce. The river was a murkier green than the sea, curving away through the jungle walls. The jaguar's tracks were everywhere along the bank, especially thick upon a tussocky rise some 5 or 6 feet above the water. This baffled Esteban. The jaguar could not drink from the rise, and it certainly would not sleep there. He puzzled over it a while, but eventually shrugged it off, returned to the beach, and because he planned to keep watch that night, took a nap beneath the palms. Some hours later, around mid-afternoon, he was started from his nap by a voice hailing him. A tall, slim, copper-skinned woman was walking toward him, wearing a dress of dark green, almost the exact color of the jungle walls that exposed the swell of her breasts. As she drew near, he saw that though her features had a patukan cast, they were of a lapidary fineness uncommon to the tribe. It was as if they had been refined into a lovely mask, cheeks planed into subtle hollows, lips sculpted full, stylized feathers of ebony inlaid for eyebrows, eyes of jet and white onyx, and all this given a human gloss. A sheen of sweat covered her breasts, and a single curl of black hair lay over her collarbone. So artful seeming, it appeared to have been placed there by design. She knelt beside him, gazing at him impassively, and Esteban was flustered by her heated air of sensuality. The sea breeze bore her scent to him, a sweet musk that reminded him of mangoes left ripening in the sun. "My name is Esteban Cax," he said, painfully aware of his own sweaty odor.
"I have heard of you,"
she said.
"The jaguar hunter. Have you come to kill the jaguar of the barrio?"
"Yes," he said, and he felt shame at admitting it. She picked up a handful of sand and watched it sift through her fingers. "What is your name?" he asked.
"If we become friends, I will tell you my name,"
she said.
"Why must you kill the jaguar?"
He told her about the television set, and then, to his surprise, he found himself describing his problems with Encarnacion, explaining how he intended to adapt to her ways. These were not proper subjects to discuss with a stranger, yet he was lured to intimacy. He thought he sensed an affinity between them, and that prompted him to portray his marriage as more dismal than it was, for though he had never once been unfaithful to Encarnacion, he would have welcomed the chance to do so now.
"This is a black jaguar," she said. "Surely you know they are not ordinary animals, that they have purposes with which we must not interfere."
Esteban was startled to hear his father's words from her mouth, but he dismissed it as coincidence and replied, "Perhaps, but they are not mine."
"Truly they are,"
she said.
"You have simply chosen to ignore them."
She scooped up another handful of sand.
"How will you do it? You have no gun, only a machete."
"I have this as well," he said, and from his sack he pulled out a small parcel of herbs and handed it to her. She opened it and sniffed the contents.
"Herbs? Ah, you plan to drug the jaguar?"
"Not the jaguar, myself." He took back the parcel. "The herbs slow the heart and give the body a semblance of death. They induce a trance, but one that can be thrown off at a moment's notice. After I chew them, I will lie down in a place that the jaguar must pass on its nightly hunt. It will think I am dead, but it will not feed unless it is sure that the spirit has left the flesh, and to determine this, it will sit on the body, so it can feel the spirit rise up. As soon as it starts to settle, I will throw off the trance and stab it between the ribs. If my hand is steady, it will die instantly."
"And if your hand is unsteady?"
"I have killed nearly 50 jaguars," he said. "I no longer fear unsteadiness. The method comes down through my family from the old Patuca, and it has never failed, to my knowledge."
"But a black jaguar?"
"Black or spotted, it makes no difference. Jaguars are creatures of instinct, and one is like another when it comes to feeding."
"Well," she said, "I cannot wish you luck, but neither do I wish you ill."
She came to her feet, brushing the sand from her dress. He wanted to ask her to stay, but pride prevented him, and she laughed as if she knew his mind.
"Perhaps we will talk again, Esteban," she said. "It would be a pity if we did not, for more lies between us than we have spoken of this day."
She walked swiftly down the beach, becoming a diminutive black figure that was rippled away by the heat haze. That evening, needing a place from which to keep watch, Esteban pried open the screen door of one of the houses, facing the beach, and went onto the porch. Chameleons skittered into the corners, and an iguana slithered off a rusty lawn chair, sheathed in spiderweb, and vanished through a gap in the floor. The interior of the house was dark and forbidding, except for the bathroom, the roof of which was missing, webbed over by vines that emitted a gray-green infusion of twilight. The cracked toilet was full of rainwater and dead insects. Uneasy, Esteban returned to the porch, cleaned the lawn chair, and sat. Out on the horizon, the sea and sky were blending in a haze of silver and gray. The wind had died, and the palms were as still as sculpture. A string of pelicans flying low above the waves seemed to be spelling a sentence of cryptic black syllables. But the eerie beauty of the scene was lost on him. He could not stop thinking of the woman. The memory of her hips rolling beneath the fabric of her dress as she walked away was repeated over and over in his thoughts, and whenever he tried to turn his attention to the matter at hand, the memory became more compelling. He imagined her naked, the play of muscles rippling her haunches, and this so inflamed him that he started to pace, unmindful of the fact that the creaking boards were signaling his presence. He could not understand her effect upon him. Perhaps, he thought, it was her defense of the jaguar, her calling to mind of all he was putting behind him. And then a realization settled over him like an icy shroud. It was commonly held among the Patuka that a man about to suffer a solitary and unexpected death would be visited by an envoy of death who, standing in for family and friends, would prepare him to face the event, and Esteban was now very sure that the woman had been such an envoy, that her allure had been specifically designed to attract his soul to its imminent fate. He sat back down in the lawn chair, numb with the realization. Her knowledge of his father's words, the odd flavor of her conversation, her intimation that more lay between them. It all accorded perfectly with the traditional wisdom. The moon rose 3/4 full, silvering the sands of the barrio. And still he sat there, rooted to the spot by his fear of death. He had been watching the jaguar for several seconds before he registered its presence. It seemed at first that a scrap of night air had fallen onto the sand and was being blown by a fitful breeze, but soon he saw that it was the jaguar, that it was inching along as if stalking some prey. Then it leaped high into the air, twisting and turning, and began to race up and down the beach, a ribbon of black water flowing across the silver sands. He had never before seen a jaguar at play, and this alone was cause for wonder. But most of all, he wondered at the fact that here were his childhood dreams come to life. He might have been peering out onto a silvery meadow of the moon, spying on one of its magical creatures. His fear was eroded by the sight, and like a child, he pressed his nose to the screen, trying not to blink, anxious that he might miss a single moment. At length the jaguar left off its play and came prowling up the beach toward the jungle. By the set of its ears and the purposeful sway of its walk, Esteban recognized that it was hunting. It stopped beneath a palm about 20 feet from the house, lifted its head, and tested the air. Moonlight frayed down through the fronds, applying liquid gleams to its haunches. Its eyes, glinting yellow-green, were like peepholes into a lurid dimension of fire. The jaguar's beauty was heart-stopping, the embodiment of a flawless principle, and Esteban, contrasting this beauty with the pallid ugliness of his employer, with the ugly principle that had led to his hiring, doubted that he could ever bring himself to kill it. All the following day he debated the question. He had hoped the woman would return, because he had rejected the idea that she was death's envoy. That perception, he thought, must have been induced by the mysterious atmosphere of the barrio, and he felt that if she was to argue the jaguar's cause again, he would let himself be persuaded. But she did not put in an appearance, and as he sat upon the beach, watching the evening sun decline through strata of dusky orange and lavender clouds, casting wild glitters over the sea, he understood once more that he had no choice. Whether or not the jaguar was beautiful, whether or not the woman had been on a supernatural errand, he must treat these things as if they had no substance. The point of the hunt had been to deny mysteries of this sort, and he had lost sight of it under the influence of old dreams. He waited until moonrise to take the herbs, and then lay down beneath the palm tree where the jaguar had paused the previous night. Lizards whispered past in the grasses, sand fleas hopped onto his face. He hardly felt them, sinking deeper into the languor of the herbs. The fronds overhead showed an ashen green in the moonlight, lifting, rustling, and the stars between their feathered edges flickered crazily as if the breeze were fanning their flames. He became immersed in the landscape, savoring the smells of brine and rotting foliage that were blowing across the beach, drifting with them. But when he heard the pad of the jaguar's step, he came alert. Through narrowed eyes he saw it sitting a dozen feet away, a bulky shadow craning its neck toward him, investigating his scent. After a moment, it began to circle him, each circle a bit tighter than the one before, and whenever it passed out of view he had to repress a trickle of fear. Then, as it passed close on the seaward side, he caught a whiff of its odor, a sweet, musky odor that reminded him of mangoes left ripening in the sun. Fear welled up in him, and he tried to banish it, to tell himself that the odor could not possibly be what he thought. The jaguar snarled, a razor stroke of sound that slit the peaceful mesh of wind and surf, and realizing it had scented his fear, he sprang to his feet, waving his machete. In a whirl of vision, he saw the jaguar leap back. Then he shouted at it, waved the machete again, and sprinted for the house where he had kept watch. He slipped through the door and went staggering into the front room. There was a crash behind him, and turning, he had a glimpse of a huge black shape struggling to extricate itself from a moonlit tangle of vines and ripped screen. He darted into the bathroom, sat with his back against the toilet bowl, and braced the door shut with his feet. The sound of the jaguar's struggle subsided, and for a moment he thought it had given up. Sweat left cold trails down his sides. His heart pounded. He held his breath, listening, and it seemed the whole world was holding its breath as well. The noises of wind and surf and insects were a faint seething. Moonlight shed a sickly white radiance through the enlaced vines overhead, and a chameleon was frozen among peels of wallpaper beside the door. He let out a sigh and wiped the sweat from his eyes. He swallowed. Then the top panel of the door exploded, shattered by a black paw. Splinters of rotten wood flew into his face, and he screamed. The sleek wedge of the jaguar's head thrust through the hole, roaring. A gateway of gleaming fangs guarding a plush red throat. Half paralyzed, Esteban jabbed weakly with the machete. The jaguar withdrew, reached in with its paw, and clawed at his leg. More by accident than design, he managed to slice the jaguar, and the paw, too, was withdrawn. He heard it rumbling in the front room, and then seconds later, a heavy thump against the wall behind him. The jaguar's head appeared above the edge of the wall. It was hanging by its forepaws, trying to gain a perch from which to leap down into the room. Esteban scrambled to his feet and slashed wildly, severing vines. The jaguar fell back, yowling. For a while, it prowled along the wall, fuming to itself. Finally, there was silence. When sunlight began to filter through the vines, Esteban walked out of the house and headed down the beach to Puerto Morada. He went with his head lowered, desolate, thinking of the grim future that awaited him after he returned the money to Onofrio. A life of trying to please an increasingly shrewish Encarnacion, of killing lesser jaguars for much less money. He was so mired in depression that he did not notice the woman until she called to him. She was leaning against a palm about 30 feet away, wearing a filmy white dress through which he could see the dark jut of her nipples. He drew his machete and backed off a pace.
"Why do you fear me, Esteban?"
she called, walking toward him. "You tricked me into revealing my method in trying to kill me," he said. "Is there not reason for fear?"
"I did not know you or your method in that form. I knew only that you were hunting me. But now the hunt has ended, and we can be as man and woman."
He kept his machete at point. "What are you?" he asked. She smiled.
"My name is Miranda. I am Patuca."
"Patucas do not have black fur and fangs."
"I am of the old Patuca," she said. "We have this power."
"Keep away!" He lifted the machete as if to strike, and she stopped just beyond his reach.
"You can kill me if that is your wish, Esteban."
She spread her arms, and her breasts thrust forward against the fabric of her dress.
"You are stronger than I, now. But listen to me first."
He did not lower the machete, but his fear and anger were being overridden by a sweeter emotion.
"Long ago," she said, "there was a great healer who foresaw that one day the Patuca would lose their place in the world, and so, with the help of the gods, he opened a door into another world, where the tribe could flourish. But many of the tribe were afraid and would not follow him. Since then, the door has been left open for those who would come after."
She waved at the ruined houses.
"Barrio Carolina is the site of the door, and the jaguar is its guardian. But soon the fevers of this world will sweep over the barrio, and the door will close forever. For though our hunt has ended, there is no end to hunters or to greed."
She came a step nearer.
"If you listen to the sounding of your heart, you will know this is the truth.
He half believed her. Yet he also believed her words masked a more poignant truth, one that fitted inside the other the way his machete fitted into its sheath.
"What is it?"
she asked.
"What troubles you?"
"I think you have come to prepare me for death," he said, "and that your door leads only to death."
"Then why do you not run from me?"
She pointed toward Puerto Morata.
"That is death, Esteban. The cries of the gulls are death, and when the hearts of lovers stop at the moment of greatest pleasure, that, too, is death. This world is no more than a thin covering of life drawn over a foundation of death, like a scum of algae upon a rock. Perhaps you are right. Perhaps my world lies beyond death. The two ideas are not opposed. But if I am death to you, Esteban, then it is death you love."
He turned his eyes to the sea, not wanting her to see his face.
"I do not love you," he said.
"Love awaits us," she said. "And someday you will join me in my world."
He looked back to her, ready with a denial, but was shocked to silence. Her dress had fallen to the sand, and she was smiling. The litheness and purity of the jaguar were reflected in every line of her body. Her secret hair was so absolute a black that it seemed an absence in her flesh. She moved close, pushing aside the machete. The tips of her breasts brushed against him, warm through the coarse cloth of his shirt. Her hands cupped his face, and he was drowning in her heated scent, weakened by both fear and desire.
"We are of one soul, you and I," she said. "One blood and one truth. You cannot reject me."
Days passed, though Esteban was unclear as to how many. Night and day were unimportant incidences of his relationship with Miranda, serving only to color their lovemaking with a spectral or a sunny mood, and each time they made love, it was as if a thousand new colors were being added to his senses. He had never been so content. Sometimes, gazing at the haunted facades of the barrio, he believed that they might well conceal shadowy avenues leading to another world. However, when Miranda tried to convince him to leave with her, he refused. He could not overcome his fear and would never admit, even to himself, that he loved her. He attempted to fix his thoughts on Encarnacion, hoping this would undermine his fixation with Miranda and free him to return to Puerto Morata. But he found that he could not picture his wife except as a black bird hunched before a flickering gray jewel. Miranda, however, seemed equally unreal at times. Once, as they sat on the bank of the Rio Dulce, watching the reflection of the moon, almost full, floating upon the water, she pointed to it and said,
"My world is that near, Esteban, that touchable. You may think the moon above is real, and this is only a reflection, but the thing most real, that most illustrates the real, is the surface that permits the illusion of reflection. Passing through this surface is what you fear, and yet it is so insubstantial you would scarcely notice the passage."
"You sound like the old priest who taught me philosophy," said Esteban. "His world, his heaven, was also philosophy. Is that what your world is? The idea of a place? Or are there birds and jungles and rivers?"
Her expression was in partial eclipse, half moonlit, half shadowed, and her voice revealed nothing of her mood.
"No more than there are here," she said.
"What does that mean?" he said angrily. "Why will you not give me a clear answer?"
"If I were to describe my world, you would simply think me a clever liar."
She rested her head on his shoulder.
"Sooner or later you will understand. We did not find each other merely to have the pain of being parted."
In that moment, her beauty, like her words, seemed a kind of evasion, obscuring the dark and frightening beauty beneath. And yet he knew that she was right, that no proof of hers could persuade him contrary to his fear. One afternoon, an afternoon of such brightness that it was impossible to look at the sea without squinting, they swam out to a sandbar that showed as a thin, curving island of white against the green water. Esteban floundered and splashed, but Miranda swam as if born to the element. She darted beneath him, tickling him, pulling at his feet, eeling away before he could catch her. They walked along the sand, turning over starfish with their toes, collecting whelks to boil for their dinner. And then Esteban spotted a dark stain, hundreds of yards wide, that was moving below the water beyond the bar, a great school of king mackerel.
"It is too bad we have no boat," he said. "Mackerel would taste better than whelks."
"We need no boat," she said. "I will show you an old way of catching fish."
She traced a complicated design in the sand, and when she had done, she led him into the shallows and had him stand facing her a few feet away.
"Look down at the water between us," she said. "Do not look up, and keep perfectly still until I tell you."
She began to sing with a faltering rhythm, a rhythm that put him in mind of the ragged breezes of the season. Most of the words were unfamiliar, but others he recognized as patuka. After a minute he experienced a wave of dizziness, as if his legs had grown long and spindly, and he was now looking down from a great height, breathing rarefied air. Then a tiny, dark stain materialized below the expanse of water between him and Miranda. He remembered his grandfather's stories of the old patuka, how, with the help of the gods, they had been able to shrink the world, to bring enemies close and cross vast distances in a matter of moments. But the gods were dead, their powers gone from the world. He wanted to glance back to shore and see if he and Miranda had become coppery giants taller than the palms.
"Now,"
she said, breaking off her song,
"you must put your hand into the water on the seaward side of the school and gently wiggle your fingers, very gently. Be sure not to disturb the surface."
But when Esteban made to do as he was told, he slipped and caused a splash. Miranda cried out. Looking up, he saw a wall of jade-green water bearing down on them, its face thickly studded with the fleeting dark shapes of the mackerel. Before he could move, the wave swept over the sandbar and carried him under, dragging him along the bottom and finally casting him onto shore. The beach was littered with flopping mackerel. Miranda lay in the shallows, laughing at him. Esteban laughed too, but only to cover up his rekindled fear of this woman who drew upon the powers of dead gods. He had no wish to hear her explanation. He was certain she would tell him that the gods lived on in her world, and this would only confuse him further. Later that day, as Esteban was cleaning the fish, while Miranda was off picking bananas to cook with them, the sweet little ones that grew along the riverbank, a Land Rover came jouncing up the beach from Puerto Morata, an orange fire of the setting sun dancing on its windshield. It pulled up beside him, and Onofrio climbed out the passenger side. A hectic flush dappled his cheeks, and he was dabbing his sweaty brow with a handkerchief. Raimundo climbed out the driver's side and leaned against the door, staring hatefully at Esteban.
9 days and not a word, said Onofrio gruffly. We thought you were dead. How goes the hunt?
Esteban set down the fish he had been scaling and stood. I have failed, he said. I will give you back the money. Raimundo chuckled, a dull, cluttered sound, and Onofrio grunted with amusement.
Impossible, he said. Encarnacion has spent the money on a house in Barrio Clarín. You must kill the jaguar.
I cannot, said Esteban. I will repay you somehow. The Indian has lost his nerve, father.
Raimundo spat in the sand.
Let me and my friends hunt the jaguar.
The idea of Raimundo and his loutish friends thrashing through the jungle was so ludicrous that Esteban could not restrain a laugh.
Be careful, Indian.
Raimundo banged the flat of his hand on the roof of the car.
It is you who should be careful, said Esteban. Most likely the jaguar will be hunting you.
Esteban picked up his machete. And whoever hunts this jaguar will answer to me as well. Raimundo reached for something in the driver's seat and walked around in front of the hood. In his hand was a silvered automatic.
I await your answer, he said.
Put that away.
Onofrio's tone was that of a man addressing a child, whose menace was inconsequential, but the intent surfacing in Raimundo's face was not childish. A tick marred the plump curve of his cheek, the ligature of his neck was cabled, and his lips were drawn back in a joyless grin. It was, thought Esteban, strangely fascinated by the transformation, like watching a demon dissolve its false shape, the true lean features melting up from the illusion of the soft.
"This son of a whore insulted me in front of Julia!"
Raimundo's gun hand was shaking.
"Your personal differences can wait," said Onofrio. "This is a business matter."
He held out his hand. "Give me the gun."
"If he is not going to kill the jaguar, what use is he?"
said Raimundo.
"Perhaps we can convince him to change his mind."
Onofrio beamed at Esteban.
"What do you say? Shall I let my son collect his debt of honor? Or will you fulfill our contract?"
"Father,"
complained Raimundo, his eyes flicked sideways. Esteban broke for the jungle. The gun roared, a white hot claw swiped at his side, and he went flying. For an instant, he did not know where he was, but then, one by one, his impressions began to sort themselves. He was lying on his injured side, and it was throbbing fiercely. Sand crusted his mouth and eyelids. He was curled up around his machete, which was still clutched in his hand. Voices above him, sand fleas hopping on his face. He resisted the urge to brush them off and lay without moving. The throb of his wound and his hatred had the same red force behind them.
"Carry him to the river,"
Raimundo was saying, his voice a tremble with excitement.
"Everyone will think the jaguar killed him."
"Fool," said Onofrio. "He might have killed the jaguar, and you could have had a sweeter revenge. His wife."
"This was sweet enough," said Raimundo.
A shadow fell over Esteban, and he held his breath. He needed no herbs to deceive this pale, flabby jaguar.